News Talk Sunday.
Surrounding me, three of them, surrounding me in a circle. And they're going to be talking about a very eclectic set of items. We've got Donald Trump, we've got Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, and we've got rugby. You wouldn't normally put those three together, but let me introduce them. So I have Emma Blaine, who's a Fine Gael councillor and former Lord Mayor of Dublin. I have Larry Donnelly, who's a law lecturer at the University of Galway and a columnist with the Journal.ie. And I have Gary Murphy, who's a professor of politics at DCU. Folks, you're all very welcome. You all look good for a Sunday morning. I've been told on pain of debt to get your reaction to yesterday's rugby match. So, come on, somebody start it off.
Well, I grew up in the 1970s and 80s, where you'd watch Fred Cogley on commentary talking about Ireland getting another tanking from England in Twickenham. So every second year they'd go with great hopes and get beat out the gate. So to see Ireland get a record score yesterday was something to astonish in one way, but it was an extraordinary victory, guaranteed literally from the first 20 minutes, I thought, where England looked as if they'd be still there trying to score. And when Ireland attacked, they just looked extraordinary. And in the aftermath of the grimness of the defeat in Paris to an outstanding French team where people said this is the end of Irish rugby as we know it, I think yesterday gave us our answer.
I suddenly realised how much the public enjoy seeing pundits being wrong. You know, this is strangely a satisfying experience. Emma?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like Gary, I mean, I have a 12-year-old boy and I've spent most of his life telling him that this is not the way things used to be, that we used to be going home with a wooden spoon every season. But yesterday, I mean, between yesterday afternoon and the sunshine this morning, I think we've come out of hibernation gloriously. It was a really special afternoon watching it in the comfort of my own home, so I could hear every little thing happening.
Yeah, I found myself being ungenerous when England scored some late tries. You normally say, look, it's, you know, good luck to them, they made a late. No. I was kind of like, can we not just get nil?
Yeah, or could we
sounds
get to
very
50?
Ungracious, but, I mean, 50 Larry, was... did you enjoy it?
I did. I'm not a big rugby guy, but I watched some of it. It was a pleasant surprise. I actually thought England would come out hopping mad after the Scotland match, and to see Ireland win as comprehensively as they did was great. I have to say my pleasure at that was greatly dampened later on by the Galway footballers throwing away a 12-point lead. Wow. to lose to Roscommon. So a good day, but a bad evening. I'm hoping today that the United States hockey team will go out and win the gold medal against Canada.
You sound like a sports addict. You're just going from one screen to the next across all the codes, you know. Anyway, right in the middle of the match, of course, Donald Trump decided to issue a new tariff threat. So I was like, flicking through my timeline and enjoying all these lovely rugby-related sort of memes and so on. And there it was. World, you're getting another 15% tariff. And that, again, he's dominating proceedings this morning. Gary, I mean, we're backward and forward on this tariff thing. Obviously, the Supreme Court was a huge setback to him. He seems to have taken it very personally. He's described them as lapdogs, rhinos, left-wing radicals were some of the phrases he used, even though, obviously, he appointed some of these particular individuals. So where do you think the Trump universe is at the moment? Is this sort of a blustery reaction to that, or is he actually going to double down on the tariff agenda?
Yeah, I think it's a blustery reaction, Emmett. I've been teaching American politics for a long time at DCU, and when the Trump tariff thing came up, I kept saying to my students, we can't do this. This is tariffs are Congress's prerogative. I was not terribly surprised by the Supreme Court decision, 6-3, of which two of the justices who voted in the majority were Trump appointees.
Gorsuch and Coney Barrett.
Barrett, yeah. Gorsuch is first in 2017 after the Merrick Garland, who was Obama's nominee, was let lapse. And then Coney Barrett just before the 2020 presidential election. But both of an independent mind, I think. And it seemed pretty obvious to me that presidents do not have unilateral action on tariffs. Now, Trump has formed with the Supreme Court in 2020. Again, many listeners will know he wanted the Supreme Court to intervene in the presidential election and basically to declare him the winner. That was never going to happen because the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who voted in the majority during the week, was cognizant of what happened in Bush versus Gore in 2000, where the Supreme Court intervened and the public opinion of the court went into serious abeyance. So in that context, I wasn't surprised. Anyone who has been watching Trump for as long as we have, he does tend to do things instantly. But then the announcement that he was going to have this 15% global tariff, as if it was to say, you can say what you want in the Supreme Court, but I'll do what the people elected me to.
And I've taken out his fact sheet, as I was saying to you guys when you all arrived. You have his sort of rhetorical statements, then you have the real stuff. What does actually this 15% tariff mean? And you do see there in the fact sheet issued by the White House, pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical ingredients are exempt from this 15% tariff, is what he's saying for now. He then has a separate agreement with a lot of pharma companies, including Pfizer, where their particular drugs are exempted from the tariffs. So we're all clear on all of this so far. Larry, where are you on the tariff thing? I mean, obviously he's losing the Supreme Court on this issue, but do you read anything wider into, in other words, are they revolting against him just on tariffs, or is he sitting there in the White House thinking, I can't rely on this court as much as I used to be able to do?
Well, I mean, one of the things that people have said, and I think they've been wrong about this, was that Trump wholly owns the United States Supreme Court. Two justices he owns, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who were in the tank for Trump and who dissented in this case. Brett Kavanaugh dissented in the case, but he largely was drawing on the fact that, what the hell are we going to do now? This is going to be a total mess in terms of what sort of remedy we're going to put in place here and how we're going to refund all this money. And I suppose he does have a point on that front. But Amy Comey Barrett, clearly, and Neil Gorsuch, who wrote a blistering dissent into Gary's point, correctly said, look, Congress, you got to start doing your job because the United States Congress has ceded so much control to both the executive.
Great phrase he used. This is not a kingly prerogative.
To both the executive and the judicial branches. People run for Congress, you'd think they'd be interested in power, but they seem happy enough to send it over to the other branches. On the tariff issue more broadly, I think it's important to note that Trump does have other authorities. He does have other sources of law that he can at least colorably.
But can they be appealed as well?
Oh, of course. This is going to go straight to court. But in the short term, he can do this stuff. But the issue then becomes these have had deleterious consequences for the American economy. He knows that. He has to know it despite all of his bluster and nonsense. And he's got to hear that from Republicans who are facing down the barrel of midterm elections. And if he were to implement these policies, even on a short-term basis, those deleterious consequences on the American people could be even greater, thus further increasing the potential for a real wipeout of Republicans in the midterm. So he's incensed. He's full of bluster. He's full of all this stuff. Obviously, Ireland is exposed on this front, so we have to take note of it. But where to lead, who knows?
Okay, Emma, your party will be interested in following this. I see Simon Harrod saying we're monitoring events and so on and so forth. But Micheál Martin going to the White House was already a kind of a dangerous, precarious meeting already. Now with this stuff kind of bubbling away, pharmaceuticals being mentioned in and out of the story, he'll be sitting with Donald Trump in a few weeks' time. So it's just making that particular meeting look very, very edgy on what might happen there. Or maybe not.
I don't know. I think there's always something bubbling with Trump, So it is, as it is, a great opportunity for our leader to sit down with the leader of the United States and have that soft diplomacy that we use to our.
You might move into the microphone a bit more.
Oh, sorry, sorry. But yeah, like I said, there is always something bubbling under the surface with him, and it's a great opportunity for us to make our case in a couple of weeks.
None of you can say this, and I don't expect you to say it either, but when it comes to these November elections, you must all be rooting for the Democrats. Yeah, I know you can't. You're looking at me, okay, but they must look for some leverage that to give the Democrats control of the House of Representatives, Larry, something where they put some kind of score on the board to readdress what seems that sometimes he has total power at the moment, even though he doesn't.
Yeah, I mean,
in terms of the optics,
it's a key point. And some of Trump's actions and words would lead you to believe he actually doesn't care what happens in the midterms. But if he doesn't, he really should, because whatever about policy, let's leave that aside for one second. If Democrats get into power in the House, if they retake control, they have control of the committees. And I would immediately expect to see investigations on a whole range of different fronts. Remember, this administration has mingled foreign policy with self-enrichment to an extent I don't think we've ever seen before. And there's a lot of stuff to unearth on that front. So if Democrats win the House, and I expect that they will, you can look forward to 2 years.
But they win the U.S. Senate? Or is this that a stretch?
An outside chance. I happen to think it probably won't happen. And I happen to think that because in so many instances, Democrats let the perfect be the enemy of the good. They nominate people for offices who might excite progressives, but when it comes to the general electorate, they just can't get over the line. But we'll see. There's an outside chance. But if they win the House, we can look forward to a couple of years of Donald Trump's name being dragged through the mud incessantly.
Okay, Gary, in terms of arcs, right? So Donald Trump's arc in this second term, where do you see him on that? Like, in other words, like, is he on the way down the back? He's got some health issues. This tariff thing is getting messy. There's November elections. Or do you actually see, no, this is when he's going to be most dangerous because he's one to push back against all these forces?
Well, I think the issue, as Larry sort of eloquently addressed, is the midterm elections. If the Democrats win the House, Trump's last 2 years will be the lamest of ducks, because he will have no agenda to pursue. Well, he'll have an agenda, but it will be just stymied by a Democratic majority. And I would be a bit more hopeful for the Democrats than Larry is in relation to the Senate. I think there is significant change and concern, I think, about presidential sort of power in the United States at the moment. So the arc for Trump, it would seem to me, and he was on the stump this week. He's a much better campaigner than he is a chief executive, in my view. And he's more in his natural habitat. So I wouldn't write him off, but certainly any defeat leaves him as a lame duck. Now, the last 2 years of a second term are nearly always a lame duck as people start jostling for the next job, the presidential job. Will Trump come out saying that he can do a third term, even though the Constitution clearly says he can't, but that hasn't worried him before. So, and again, I say this to my students, for all those who think this is the end of the Republic as one knows it, no, it's not. I mean, we've been here before.
Well, that's good to hear.
But we've been here before loads of times with America at war unconstitutionally, with America doing things like, if you look at things like Venezuela, America under Reagan and Bush went into Panama and they went into Grenada.
But I don't remember Reagan and Bush saying, I'm going to do a third term. Well, you know what I mean?
Like, indeed,
that part
I do,
is
yes.
the element, isn't it?
Yeah,
but it I know is. What you mean, the decapitation of various countries.
Well, indeed,
that has happened
before.
Okay, before, yeah. We've got only a few minutes on this. Some of this next stuff I'm going to talk about, Emma, is so surreal. I do actually have some sympathy with you having to analyse some of this, but we're back to Andrew Mountbatten, Windsor. Fair degree of coverage, a lot of it front page. We've got stuff going on about, protection officers from the UK protecting an event of Jeffrey Epstein in New York. We've got a really bizarre one in the Sunday Independent about a North Korean property deal being run out of Buckingham Palace. I mean, the stuff is just, it's getting worse, it's getting deeper, it's getting more fantastical. I mean, where are we from what you've been reading this morning?
You know, I think fantastical is the absolute correct word to use there. I think when you think it can't get any worse, it does. But as we were saying before the show, I think, you know, his ex-wife is as implicit, if not more, in this than him himself. And it's just utterly disturbing, depraved. The latest uncoverings about the shady deals just make it, you know, are making a criminal and in a different way. But I do think that his arrest the other day has taken a little bit of pressure off of the royal family in some ways, in that
he's the centre, not the institution. As long as it's about him and not them.
It's about him. The police have stepped in, the Met have stepped in, they've arrested him, you know, they're taking control. Charles doesn't have to be the one. He's done what he can do so far. So now, I think in many ways, Charles may be a little bit secretly happy that he's been arrested. If he can be.
Sure. Well, actually, Larry, I was going to ask you something. I've seen some Americans and some British sort of dueling a little bit on social media where the British are saying, look, it's not great, but we have arrested this man. We've searched his premises. Whereas in the US system, you know, a lot of people, obviously Epstein cheated justice to some degree with his death, but there hasn't been a huge amount of arrests and so on and premises raided and all the rest of it. I mean, is that a fair critique or are the British being a bit previous?
No. I mean, I think it's almost a reversal. I mean, I think a lot of people around the world would have associated the United States as the place where you do the crime, you do the time, the perp walk, all that sort of thing. Yet here we have a situation where it appears, at least, that Andrew is being held to account, whereas there are countless individuals in the United States who, because of wealth and power, simply aren't being held to account. So it's a reversal of what had happened previously. I'd echo everything that Emma has said here about Andrew and indeed about his former wife. I think the whole thing is revolting. I think two things. One thing, globally, in the United States, the UK, and further afield, this will cement the perception of many people that elites play the game by different rules and that there are secret cabals of society who do all sorts of horrible things. It will fuel conspiracy theories. The second point is the monarchy, I think, is in existential territory here. This is a really, really
Believe that?
Well, I don't think I think it'll survive. But I think in terms of the public mind.
Reputationally.
Yes, I think it's probably, at least in modern history, and royalists out there can correct me.
we don't get many royalists on this program.
But certainly, if this isn't the lowest ebb, it's got to be pretty damn near it.
Yeah. Okay, listen, we'll hold that thought there, folks. We'll come back with Irish politics and a new plan by the government to make us all start investing. Gary, I'm going to start and resume this part of the session with you. We have a Red Sea poll. It's years away from a general election. These polls don't move usually dramatically, but a profession like you, I'm sure, can find some light in there.
Well, perhaps, Emmett. But yeah, as polls go, this is not the most exciting. Sinn Féin is down 1 at 23. Fine Gael stands pat at 18. Fianna Fáil up 2 at 17. And of the smaller parties, the Sock Dems are at 9, down 1 from their historic high of 10. And everyone else is in the kind of 5 to 3 range. Labour and Ainto at 5, the Greens at 3. Independents at 13. Again, not much change there. Now, just for contrast, though, this time in the last election cycle, so a year after the 2020 election, Sinn Féin were at about 34% in the poll. They had an astonishing 3-year run, practically, of being in the low 30s. And then as the election loomed ever closer, the numbers dropped to their to the scenario where Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin at the 2024 November election were all much of a muchness at about 21-22%, and that's the way the general election turned out. So we do have to take these at a caution. John Rogers, the Red Sea pollster, has an interesting piece where he talks about the poll revealing the momentum is with the left-wing parties, and to an extent it is, but we'll have two by-elections in a couple of months, which will give us, we'll see if the proof is there. A lot of talk about this so-called left coalition and a transfer pact in Galway West in particular.
Do you get a sense that a lot of voters are just tuning out at
I
the
do.
Moment? They're more Trump obsessed than Irish politics.
I do. And I mean, we have had, you know, and people are more excited by the sport because of the grim weather. And I mean, much as it pains me to say it, Emmett, and I've said it on this show many times, most people aren't terribly interested in politics. It's a fact of Sunday morning life that they're interested in reading the back pages about sport.
Gary, that for saying people are not interested in what I do for a living. This
well,
is not
indeed,
good.
And myself included in that, where I'm more interested in the sports pages on a Sunday morning than the political pages. But certainly, like I was at the Social Democrat conference a couple of weeks ago in Cork City. I'd been invited down to give part of a panel, notwithstanding that I've been often critical of the Sock Dems. But what struck me, though, was that they were very bullish about their chances in Dublin Central in the by-election.
They got a lot of publicity for their conference.
They had a big crowd at it. I'm also happy to report that there is still a lot of socialising at conferences. This is not a remnant of the great Fianna Fáil Ardeshes of the 70s and 80s. But I was struck by the enthusiasm they had for their candidate, Daniel Ennis, in Dublin Central. Now, I think Dublin Central is a huge by-election for Sinn Féin and for Mary Lou MacDonald in particular. If Sinn Féin can't win that seat in the heartland of their leader, well, what would that tell us about the chances of Sinn Féin leading the next government?
Okay. Emma, we have a fascinating story about your party, a kind of slightly surreal story on the Sunday Times. Now, Turning Point USA, for those who don't know, which is probably quite a large amount of people, is associated with the deceased activist Charlie Kirk. And according to this story, anyway, they see Fine Gael, of all parties, as a possible soul brother or sister for them as they sort of try to sort of delve into European politics. Very strange and surreal.
Yeah, you can't see me.
I can't see the natural connection through
the airwaves. But this was actually sent around.
I could see, not Fine Gael.
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple of people and individuals I could see them associating themselves with, but certainly not Fine Gael. And one of my colleagues sent this around our councillor's WhatsApp group last night, and it was just greeted with tumbleweed because people were just, you know, incredulous. I think your man would want to do a bit of homework before he starts coming into the, not that I think that there's a market for them here anyway necessarily, you know, but certainly not with Fine Gael.
Well, another, okay, let's make more strange connections, like a bad blind date. Larry, we have Sinn Féin's funding being scrutinised very extensively in the Sunday Times. Like, they've given a lot of words to it and a lot of research to it. And they've looked at who gave the money in the United States. Some of them are people with connections to the Republican Party, the US Republican Party, not Republicanism, and property developers and their various US businessmen, mainly men. And I mean, it's a strange kind of bag of people that Sinn Féin wouldn't normally consort with if it was in an Irish context.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, this is not surprising in some respects in that Sinn Féin has for a long time cultivated support in the United States and cultivated donors. How it works exactly under the laws regarding campaign donations, Gary could probably explain in better detail than I could, but they do make it
He's
work.
He's watching sports.
They do make it work one way or another. But one of the things that has fascinated me is that an awful lot of those people who don't and entities who donate to them, they must either be ignorant of or just turn a blind eye towards a lot of Sinn Féin's policies outside of advocating for a united Ireland. As a result, it doesn't surprise me that people and friends of Sinn Féin USA donate to Republican candidates in the United States, because an awful lot of them would be politically conservative. And indeed, they must either, again, be ignorant of or turn a blind eye to Sinn Féin's position, for instance, on Israel. I think that they would look the other way or be appalled by it if they knew the detail of
so
it.
Does this mean there's so much money swilling around the U.S. system that people don't need to look that much? They just say, here, have a few dollars.
Yeah, and part of this, this is an important thing, part of this, especially in New York City, where you have these dinners and people here go off the wall, they say $1,000 plate dinner. That's pretty much a cost of doing business in New York. And people spread money across a whole range of different causes.
You can raise money reasonably easily.
Very, very easy. I mean, political donations in the United States are a fact of life. And one of the things I always say is that I actually don't know anyone in the United States who's never made a political donation of one kind or another. I'd have to look very hard around Ireland to find people who've made political donations. So it's a very different system. But it does highlight, I suppose, the real dissonance between what Sinn Féin stands for.
They keep riding those two horses, in your view.
Well, it hasn't caused them a problem yet. I do note one interesting thing. A&2 was mentioned in a different context a few minutes ago. I thought it was interesting that Pat O'Bean went over to the United States. And I think that was probably a line saying, look, we're committed to United Ireland as well. But you know what else? We're more like you guys when it comes to things like abortion. We're on your side. And I think they're trying to mine some of that as well.
Gary, I mean, is it a good idea to sort of align yourself with this US political sort of network? I mean, as long as the Sunday Times people like that don't write about it too often, it's probably reasonably risk-free.
Yeah, well, it's a source of extraordinary income. Mm. And we know that Sinn Féin are by some distance Ireland's wealthiest party. And there are different rules in Britain than there are in the Republic here. And a lot of the money for Sinn Féin, I think, goes through. It's sort of, it's Northern Office. So, I mean, I think a lot of Americans will associate Sinn Féin when Mary Lou MacDonald, about 7 or 8 years ago, famously held up that banner, England, get out of Ireland, at the New York St. Patrick's Day parade, which kind of summed up, I think, how many Americans will think of Sinn Féin as the Irish unity party. But as Larry stated, they dig a little bit underneath the surface and... there are very few points of a similarity, with the exception of a United Ireland, between those who are donating this money and the way they think about politics. They are pro-Israel, they are pro-life or anti-choice, to use that phrase, and of course that's been a division for Sinn Féin. That's why
so does it strike you as strange that the opposition parties, the government parties, should I say, people who are opposition to Sinn Féin, don't make more use of this stuff? Why is it the Sunday Times that's bringing out at these disclosures? If I was in Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, would this not be fertile territory?
Well, to be fair, they have been trying to alert, I suppose, and Fianna Fáil particularly for decades were trying to dig into the American market as a source of funds, and that really went nowhere. And it's a very sort of dichotomous view that Irish Americans have of Ireland. Great fans of the peace process, certainly, but if you're willing to donate money, you think Sinn Féin are the more likely party to have a united Ireland, I'll donate some money. to them. But certainly, I mean, Sinn Féin aren't the only party, to be fair, who have looked to gain money out of the American system. And, I mean, listeners will be interested really to know this week has been all about Sinn Féin saying they're not going to go to the St. Patrick's Day festivities, and then the American ambassador coming out and said, well, they weren't invited in the first place.
So there'll be no money that particular week.
Indeed.
Emma, do you think your party are likely to dig into this stuff, or have they tried before and it didn't really take any great momentum, or what's your own view on this?
To dig into the American market?
Yeah, and who these people are. And as Larry points out, the inconsistency between taking property developer money from the US, but when it comes to Ireland, being quite, you know, anti-property developer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think my own party is busy running the country and getting to grips with all the challenges that are there. But yeah, I think to Larry and Gary's points both on this, those donators, I think, very much are buying into this, you know, this...
It's the United Ireland fundraiser.
Yeah, and it's a kind of a... It's more like a fantasy, and they don't... They're not interested in looking into the deeper, into the actual... Much like your man from Turning Point, it's what they see at the surface. They're not looking...
I like when you refer to him as your man.
Yeah, your man.
You can hear the derision dripping from your voice.
Yeah, but it's buying into that. A bit of the diddly eye, you know, as well, going on there, I think. But... Yeah, it's a
sort of a misty-eyed sort
it is a misty-eyed
four green fields that, type
that
of money,
I think, and that's been ongoing for decades now.
Okay. So. Larry, anytime I come in here any Sunday, I'm sure you're the same, I'm sure Emma's the same, and I'm sure Gary's the same. We talk about the whole military problem in terms of lack of funding. When we do procure military equipment, it seems to be the wrong stuff or it doesn't work properly. We have the EU presidency starting in the summer. We still seem to be, in terms of the weight of the coverage overall, behind the eight ball a little bit, to put it mildly, there. We have a story in the Sunday Independent today that Helen McEntee is scrambling to strengthen security as threats grow. I mean, how worried are you, as somebody who lives here, but also watches these things and observes them, about how this whole EU presidency is going to go based on some of these reports?
Well, if you read the Sunday Independent piece, you'd be extremely concerned. It paints a pretty bleak picture of our capacity. When you think of the amount of maritime territory, it's absolutely massive. And we certainly, frankly speaking, don't have the capacity to defend it. And I think that's manifestly clear. And how we've gotten to this position, I think, you know, look, there are lots of different reasons. We don't want to go over ancient history. But the fact is, and I am happy to see that we are starting to make some investment in terms of our defense. It's incumbent upon us, not just as a nation, but as part of the European Union. It is our duty. And I think that one of the things that's important is whenever you see discussions of military, we can't really have a rational discussion, because it deteriorates into this thing of, oh, spending money on the military, that means our neutrality might be in jeopardy, that means your sons are going to be sent off to fight for some European army, and all this sort of hysteria, when the blatant truth is we need to up our game. And I've heard countless people from the defense forces, including those at the very highest levels, make this point in public, in dignified terms, and make this point in private, in what I would say are less than dignified, quite exasperated terms. And one of the other points that's here is this isn't just about, you know, equipment and all that sort of thing. The other thing we need to do is we need to make the defense forces an attractive option for young people. And the fact is, the pay and conditions are absolutely abysmal. You would be better, perhaps even far better, working at Tesco than joining the military in many respects. And for a lot of young people, I know this from the United States, for a lot of young people, especially those finding it tough in their early years, whatever, grappling with adulthood, joining the military can be a formative experience and really put them on a great path. That should be available to more of our citizens and be an attractive option.
Gary, how the politics of this is playing out, I mean, this is my own read of it, so shoot it down by all means, but you've got the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil parties are more into investing. You've then got Sinn Féin are at least ambiguous. They've been exposed a little bit in the last week on this whole Ukraine position, so much so that they've been writing letters into the paper to sort of lay out their position. Then we have where the public are, which is, you still see neutrality is quite a strong support, triple lock, maybe less so. So do you see anything moving, or are we sort of locked into sort of standard patterns where people like neutrality, they want to make some investments, but let's not get too excitable? Is that where the public sentiment is in your view?
I think it is. Neutrality does remain very popular. And certainly all the polling would suggest that even in the aftermath of Russia's barbaric war in Ukraine, that people are keen on neutrality. Now, I tend to think that Sinn Féin are on pretty dangerous territory with their with the votes of their MEPs not to fund Ukraine. Pierce Doherty, I think, got a pretty hard time and a fair time from Shane Coleman of this parish a couple of weeks ago on the hard shoulder when Shane pushed him very strongly about that Vladimir Putin wasn't going to listen to Sinn Féin and its views that there should be no money spent on war when Ukraine is existentially fighting for its life. Now, to your point about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael wanting to invest, Emmett, I'm not widely convinced about that, simply on the grounds. To Larry's point is that for years there has been underinvestment in the security of the state in relation to army numbers, naval numbers, our inability to protect our waters, our inability to protect our skies.
So does it need an event to sort of maybe...
Well, hopefully not, I would say.
No, what I mean is, let me sketch this out. It's sort of unfreeze there where everyone is at. Mm. If we have RAF pilots coming into Irish airspace to get rid of drones or whatever... Does the public sort of shift then and say, okay, this is really bad?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think the public would simply move on to the next event. I mean, the reality is, and let's remember, both Micheál Martin and Simon Harris, in their respective positions, I think as Minister for Foreign Affairs, were also ministers for defence. In other words, defence is sort of an add-on to the Foreign Affairs portfolio. And little, in my view, has changed. But I think the overriding point, Emmett, is neutrality remains popular. There is no, notwithstanding those on the far left would say that Ireland has been soft enough for NATO, there is no trend for Ireland join NATO. That's not going to happen.
So we would be neutral, but more and better resourced. That's where we're trying to get to.
I think that's what the government is trying to do, but I'm not sure that the public is actually even that interested in it.
Okay. Emma, I mean, are you hearing much in your own party about this whole issue? Is it coming up more and more all the time? Are you feeling the salience of it is growing all the time?
Yeah,
you're all talking on WhatsApp groups and all the rest of it.
Yeah, a bit more of it, yeah. And I would say, back to Larry's point as well, again, about the whole recruitment of the Defence Forces, like, I think it really does need to be made an attractive option for graduates, for people who've had other careers. You know, during my term as Lord Mayor, I had an awful lot to do with the Defence Forces, both serving and the veterans. And they are extraordinary men and women who've given so much to our country, to our defences. And it's a great career that can lead on to so many other avenues. So, you know, I think the government needs to invest in some kind of proper recruitment drive and make that.
Get better people, better more paper, people, higher skill level, people interested in it, an option as it is in the US.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Britain, of course. Yeah. A lot of people from the north of England have traditionally gone into the British armed forces. Let's shift gears. Gary, you've been writing about taxis this week, which I don't normally associate you with, but you're moving into that space. We've been talking about this whole Uber thing. Should they be allowed to operate like a sort of a ride sharing kind of company and ordinary folk can just jump into an Uber and pick you up, which some people that I know, I don't necessarily want to rely on their driving, but that's a separate issue. But you're highlighting issues in rural Ireland as well that we just can't get around a lot of the time.
Yeah, so this is in light of the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission report earlier in the week, Emmett, which basically called for a deregulation of the industry. And I was making the point that we had been here before in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when the then Fianna Fáil Progressive Democrat government deregulated the industry. And remember, this was the time where taxi plates
Was it Bobby Malloy, if I recall?
Yeah, and Noel Dempsey. Yeah. And taxi plates were worth like 150,000
overnight, pounds. They then were reduced to nothing.
Yeah, indeed, and that caused huge consternation. But there was no evidence that politically this affected Fianna Fáil, and Fianna Fáil in particular, because they nearly won an overall majority in 2002. But my point is, it shouldn't be beyond the bounds of the political class, both administratively in the civil service and in our elected representative, to come up with some scenario where people in rural Ireland are able to get a home after a night out. Now, the government constantly talks, rightly in my view, but whether the proof has come to fruition is another question, about regenerating rural Ireland. And if you can't go and get a taxi home, well, what can you do?
We'll have to have that for another conversation. Emma Blaine, thank you very much. She's a Fine Gael councillor. Larry Donnelly is law lecturer at the University of Galway. And Gary Murphy, you just heard there, professor of politics at DCU. Thank you to all.
News Talk Sunday.